Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you again for your support during this fall membership campaign. Voters in Key West have a say in how the city does business with the cruise industry. Three referendums that could dramatically cut the number of cruise ships and visitors to the island are up for vote. The outcome is sure to have an impact on the environment, health, and economy that has already been strained by the pandemic. That the cruise industry is also continuing to reel from. Earlier today, we spoke with Miami Herald reporter Taylor Dolvin and WLRN's Keys reporter Nan Klinginer. Nan, I want to start with you. Remind us of the referendum before voters.
In Key West, voters will be deciding whether cruise ships should be limited to 1,500 people a day maximum who get off cruise ships in Key West. That the ships that call here can carry 1,300 people maximum, and whether to prioritize ships with the best health and safety environmental records.
Taylor, what do we know about how the cruise industry is viewing this vote?
All of the biggest cruise companies, Carnival Corporation, Royal Caribbean Group, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, had ships that visited Key West in 2019 and had plans to return their ships to visit Key West in 2021. So these referendums would definitely have an impact on their business plans. The industry lobbying group CLIA hasn't specifically weighed in on these referendums, but I anticipate that if they do pass, we'll be hearing from them after the election.
And there are other cities around the world, like Key West, where cruise ships like to port for a day or two. They're watching this vote very carefully.
Yes, there's a newly formed group of port city activists who are advocating for fewer ships, smaller ships, similar efforts called the Global Cruise Activist Network. And actually, the guys in Key West that are behind these ballot initiatives are part of that group. And so we have people from, you know, Alaska, Bahamas, Scandinavia, part of this group, all really watching to see how this plays out.
Nan, who in Key West is fighting against these referendums?
Well, there are some businesses that really benefit from the cruise ship industry. Some of our attractions and tours, some of our stores and bars. So they are definitely fighting against it. And there's also a group called Protect Our Jobs, which is a nonprofit that has been sending mailers to Key West voters with all kinds of dire consequences, they claim, if the cruise ship referendums pass.
And some of those claims are like, what, defunding police or cutting the police, right?
Right, right.
I mean, do we know, what this group is? Who's behind that group?
We don't. It was incorporated in Dade City, Florida, and its current mailing address is a mailbox at the local UPS store.
And again, just a reminder, this is not a group that has the power over the budget and the police, so they're just saying this.
Right, right. And a couple other people that have been fighting it and have even challenged these amendments in court already are the harbor pilots, the people who guide the cruise ships in, and the people who own Pier B, which is one of the major cruise ship ports here in town.
So the cruise ships have brought in nearly a million visitors to Key West last year, about half the tourists. But Nan, I mean, of those visitors, do we know how much are they spending when they're in town? Because you talk about the businesses that might be affected, but are they really, is it really that big of an economic boost?
Right. Well, the most recent study, unfortunately, on their actual spending is from 2005. And it found that they only spent $32 a day on average. And with inflation, that would be $43 a day. The Chamber of Commerce came up with an impact of $90 million from spending and all the various things that cruise ships do. So, yeah, we'll see.
But from businesses, do you get the sense they want this, but the people of Key West don't want this?
I mean, some businesses benefit from cruise lines, but many do not.
I see. Taylor, the president of the Key West Chamber of Commerce has said they would lose tens of millions of dollars. I wanted to get the sense, where does the money from the cruise industry go, actually? Like, which businesses are actually affected most, and how's it really benefiting the city?
There's sort of two different pots of money here. There's the money that passengers pay as part of a tax every time the ship arrives in Key West. And that added up to 5.9 million in 2019. And what city officials tell us is that the city spends about that amount to support the industry. They basically say, you know, we break even here as a city on our budget in terms of how much we're making from these head taxes. Then there's the spending, you know, passengers do out of pocket once they get on land at local businesses in Key West. And that is a difficult number to arrive at.
Nan, I want to ask you about two things. Let's start with the pandemic first. We remember the stories of cruise ships that were kind of just sitting out in the water with a lot of passengers and sick people and ports that didn't want to take them in. But how much is COVID-19 playing in this vote?
So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the real reasons is because if we had a serious breakout here, we have one hospital, it's got seven ICU beds, and the fear is that that could really impact the greater tourism industry, the other 1 million people who come here every year and are spending big money on hotel rooms and, you know, dive tours and fishing trips and all kinds of stuff.
And what about the environment? That's also been part of the argument, the environmental impact of these ships.
Right. Well, Taylor could tell you a lot more than me about the fines that companies like Carnival have paid tens of millions of dollars in fines for discharging plastic waste and oily discharge. The more local environmental impact is that the cruise ships stir up silt when they're coming and going from the port here in our harbor. One of the fishing captains who's part of the Safer Cleaner Ships Committee says that the harbor looks like a blasted moonscape. You know, coral heads are covered in silt and the tarpon aren't coming through here anymore like they should.
Taylor, if the vote, after the vote, I should say, that may not be the end of it. Could this face legal battles afterwards?
Yes, these referendums, if passed, are almost certain to face legal challenges from those who've sued already, the Harbor Pilots and the Walsh family, which owns Pier B in Key West, which is the only privately held cruise pier in Florida. There's also the issue that the third question here is whether the city should prioritize ships that have better health records and environmental records. It may be really elusive to actually enact that and enforce that. What does better records mean? You know, the CDC is closely tracking COVID-19 cases from cruise ships, but there's not the same oversight for environmental violations. There's no public record keeping of environmental violations from cruise ships, so it could be really hard to determine.
And Taylor, in a broader sense, I mean, what's the industry doing? When can we expect to see cruise ships back to business?
So the CDC had planned to ban cruises in the U.S. until February 2021, but was overruled by the White House last week. And so the extension on the cruise ban is now in place until October 31st. Most cruise companies, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian, Disney and Virgin Voyages aren't selling cruises until December, but Carnival Cruise Line has canceled all U.S. cruises except for Port Miami and Port Canaveral cruises that leave starting November 1st. So like you said, we could see cruises as soon as November 1st.
And you've got cruises starting up that soon. What do we know about the cruise workers? I mean, everything that they've been through, what's going to change?
Yeah, it's been an incredibly difficult time for crew members these past several months. I'm still in touch with at least two crew members who are stuck on cruise ships waiting to be repatriated without pay. They've been stuck since March 14th when the industry shut down. So as these companies are gearing up to start passenger operations again, there are still people waiting to get home. Others who've made it home were stuck for 5-6 months without pay at sea and are really suffering trauma from that time and also incredible economic hardship.
Do we know if people are buying cruises for November and December, or, you know, is fear of cruising still pervasive?
Yes, we do know that there are people who are buying cruises for the remaining months in 2020. I talked to a travel agent just a few days ago who said that the die-hard cruisers are willing to get back on these ships as soon as possible, no matter the regulations required, whether that's testing, wearing a mask. Some of the others who are more hesitant are sort of delaying their travel and switching cruises into next year or the following year. But there definitely are people who are willing and excited about getting back on these ships this year.
Nan, let me finish with you. I wonder, how does this fight in Key West tie into that long ongoing battle in the Keys that we often talk with you about, the politics of tourism versus locals?
Yeah, it's well, it's kind of a question of mass tourism versus people who can come for longer and spend more money. So there are some people who benefit greatly from, a million almost cruise ship passengers each year, and then there are others who really don't like having, 10,000 people at a time sometimes all of a sudden in the downtown Key West. So, yeah, it sort of depends on whether you're directly benefiting from the industry or not.
That was WLRN Keys reporter Nan Klingener and the Miami Herald's tourism reporter Taylor Dolvin. We have more information on the three referendum on cruise ships in Key West at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a look at the growth of hate groups in South Florida and how people are being radicalized online. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during this fall membership campaign. There's been a documented rise in hate and extremist groups over the past 4 years, this according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Proud Boys have been listed as a hate group by the SPLC and have gotten a lot of national attention. During last week's presidential debate, President Trump told the members to, quote, stand back and stand by when asked whether he would denounce white supremacy and asked members not to engage in violence during ongoing protests. Days later, the president said he condemns all white supremacists in a Fox News interview. The Proud Boys have a history of violent confrontations. One of their leaders, Henry Enrique Tario, is based here in Miami. Last year, we spoke with Heidi Byrick, who leads the intelligence project for the Southern Poverty Law Center, about the rise of these groups in South Florida. What does the Southern Poverty Law Center believe are some of the reasons, the contributing factors to the expansion of hate groups across the country these last 4 years?
Well, there's a couple things that we would point to as being driving factors. One is just the existence of the online space, which allows people to be radicalized into extremist propaganda in ways that were never possible before in history. We've had quite a few notable extremists like Dylann Roof, who shot up that black church in Charleston, who learned everything about hating black people, in that case, from the web. So that's the first factor. And the second is that we lay a lot of this at the feet of the Trump administration, which has energized white supremacists by playing to issues that they get riled up about, being anti-immigrant, being anti-Muslim. Those kinds of things are also something that has contributed to rising ranks in these groups as they feel like they have more of a stake in the political system and should get involved.
So we've seen this expansion. The report talks about expansion nationwide. But what have you seen in Florida, and specifically South Florida?
Yeah, well, Florida actually, and unfortunately, has been a place where hate groups have for a long time found a home. The oldest hate site on the web is actually in West Palm Beach. It's an outfit called Stormfront that we list as a hate group, and this is something that's been there since the mid-1990s. If you take Florida's population, which is obviously Florida is one of the three largest states in the U.S., into account, Florida still is sort of on the gradient to having more hate groups per capita than half of the states in the United States. So I think that's important. In terms of South Florida, you have a mix of all kinds of organizations. You have neo-Nazi groups like Stormfront, which I mentioned. You have the Proud Boys, which is this sort of thuggish street fighting group that describes itself as Islamophobic. You also have anti-Muslim groups in that area and quite a few organizations that we consider to be hate groups that are black nationalist groups.
So looking through the map, one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, You see all these groups, you have them listed where they're, you know, what parts of the state, what parts of the country you could find them, and information about each group. But how many of those groups, I guess, would be the best way to ask you is, are active or are actually dangerous, a threat? And how many of them are just, you know, that that's a person or a group of people there, but they're just there?
It's a fair question. So we don't put groups on our list because they're violent. That said, a large chunk of the organizations on our group have had members who engage in violence, in particular neo-Nazi groups and skinhead groups. The reason we don't list on the basis of violence is because we have far too many situations where an organization whose members are just pumping out bigoted or hateful propaganda of some sort, anti-Semitic propaganda, that material ultimately becomes an inspiration for someone to commit an act of violence. Dylan Roof is a classic example of that. As I mentioned, he wasn't a member of a hate group and he was radicalized online, but he was reading material from white supremacist groups that didn't have a track record of violence. They sort of, they end up inspiring that kind of violence. So we're actually concerned about all the groups on this list because all of them in some way target a population, whether it may be Jews, African Americans, white people, and demean them and vilify them. And that can give someone an excuse for committing a hate crime. And that's why we do this based on ideology.
So, Heidi Beirich, it's important to discern how the Southern Poverty Law Center defines what a hate group is. So what are the primary characteristics that would list them or get them on the list for you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at the ideology of the group, the statements of its leaders, what its official positions are. And what we're looking for is, does that organization vilify, demean, consider lesser an entire other population based on their inherent characteristics? So what I mean by that is, for example, do they propagate ideas like all black people are more criminal or have lower IQ, or LGBT people should be thrown in jail for engaging in same-sex relationships, or Jews are masterminds behind some kind of conspiracy to bring immigrants to the United States and should be killed? That's literally what Robert Bowers, who shot those people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, believed. We're looking for that kind of a pattern. And the key thing is, does the group consider all the members of that other population to be lesser? This is actually almost exactly the way the FBI decides whether something is a hate group, whether or not the person targeted an entire group, used a slur against Jews or African Americans in an attack. You can find those two definitions on our website at splcenter.org if you want to look at them side by side.
And one of the things right now, as you know, there are three groups suing the center for labeling them as hate groups for defamation of character. One of them, and you talked about a moment ago, the Proud Boys Club. This was started a couple of years ago in support of the Trump presidency, and they've been linked to the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, and most recently, they provided security and support to Roger Stone following his arrest in Fort Lauderdale. What do you say in response to the organization justifying your label?
Well, I mean, look, anybody can file a lawsuit. Our view on this is that we stand by our listing 100%, that we think it's absolutely fair to call the Proud Boys a hate group, both by the statements of their former leader, who has now stepped down, Gavin McInnes. He actually said at one point, I think it's fair to characterize me as an Islamophobe. In other words, somebody who hates Muslims. And I think that kind of tells you everything you need to know in terms of the listing.
Is there any concern about the center being labeled as a partisan organization when you think about the fact that a lot of these groups are linked to conservative policies or conservative individuals?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I think to myself that, for example, where that's usually laid at the feet are some of the groups that we list as anti-LGBT. And the groups that we list in that category are groups that say things like gay men, all gay men, are more likely to be pedophiles and molest children. Or they're groups that advocate for people to be sent to jail using sodomy laws, basically some old school persecution against gay and lesbians. And I have to say that I don't understand how that could be conservative. In this case, what you're doing is simply lying when you're talking about pedophilia or molestation, or you're advocating for one of the most barbarous policies that the world is throwing off. And so I don't think of that as conservative. And I would guess that most conservatives don't think about upholding those ideas as being conservative.
The other thing interesting about this report, too, is that you look at lawmakers with links to extremist organizations. One of them is a Florida congressman, Matt Gaetz. He invited Chuck Johnson to President Trump's State of the Union address. Johnson is an avowed white nationalist that started the web platform WeSearcher, used for crowdfunding alt-right groups. Why is it important for the Intelligence Project to track these lawmakers' connections? And what does it say about potential influence on policy?
Well, I mean, this is where it becomes really concerning, because now you don't have a fringe group that might be saying hateful things, maybe inspires hate crimes or something like that. But once you get close to lawmakers, or lawmakers are hanging out with members of hate groups, it can affect policy, which is terrifying. It can also give a veneer of legitimacy to extremist ideas and groups. Chuck Johnson is a Holocaust denier, and his site WeSearcher was used to raise money, for example, for a neo-Nazi who ran a trolling campaign against a Jewish woman in Whitefish, Montana. You know, I expect more out of our elected officials, one, to denounce hate, and certainly not to have connections to groups like that. So when we see that kind of mainstreaming, it's really scary and unfortunate. We've seen far too much of it, frankly, in this administration.
That was Heidi Beirich, who leads the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's a conversation we had with her in 2019 about the rise of hate groups in the U.S., especially in Florida. Well, still to come, a conversation with actor and comedian John Leguizamo. He stars in a new film about a champion chess team from Miami. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during this fall membership campaign. The year was 1998, and five students from Miami Jackson Senior High School are poised to become national chess champions. The students confronted stereotypes head-on and defied all expectations, going on to win that year and four more national championships. More than 20 years later, this story is being told on the big screen in the new film, Critical Thinking, released on demand last month. Here's an excerpt from the trailer.
We got a tournament coming up in a couple days, so we need to start really considering if we're serious about what we're doing here or not.
Oh! Oh! Daddy on the mic, yep. I get hyped. Don't mess with me, because chess is life. Yeah!
Actor, director, and comedian John Leguizamo stars in and directed the film. We spoke with Leguizamo last year about critical thinking. We also discussed his one-man show available on Netflix, Latin History for Morons. You were connected to a project called Critical Thinking.
Yes.
This is a film that you were directing and starring, and this is a fascinating story about a group of teens here in Miami at Miami Jackson Senior High. They formed a chess team. This is a group of kids from a low-income neighborhood, but they went and they competed nationally with students from...
They became United States champions.
Right.
And so I did this movie. I shot it. We shot it in Liberty City, Overtown. And one of the actors was originally from there. And it was amazing, man. I mean... Great talent in Miami. We use a lot of Miami actors, a Miami crew. It was beautiful to shoot down there, and I had real chess players be in all the competitions, and they did great by me. And I'm so proud of the film, and hopefully it'll have a big life.
You played the teacher, right?
Mario Martinez, yes. This incredible man who realized that. There are these kids in the ghetto who don't want to play football, who don't want to fight, who don't want to, you know, be consumed by the ghetto, but they have no place, these ghetto nerds. And he created this elective where they could go play chess, and these kids fell in love with the game, and they had skills and talent, and what he gave them was the book knowledge that they needed to compete at a national level, and he was relentless.
How did you come across this project?
It was offered to me by two producers, Carla Berkowitz and Scott Rosenfeld, who fell in love with this project, and Harvey Chaplin, who fell in love with it as well. And they wanted to see this come to life, and here we are, 3 years later.
It's a fascinating story that so many of us down here have heard, and looking forward to that film because we've wanted to see it on the big screen. You know, looking at clips of the show, and anybody who's ever had the chance to at least see that, you know, you are very professorial, if that's the right way to say it, is you're on stage dressed like a professor. You even have a chalkboard, for heaven's sakes. And but you're basically talking to us about what you've learned about Latin history.
I hope to educate people in a funny, funny way where they want to read the literature that I read, the books that I read, where people will want to go change curriculums and change textbooks to include our contributions. I mean, because the stuff that I found was so incredible. The fact that I found out that Latin people are the second oldest ethnic group in America after Native Americans, and that we have fought in every single war this country's ever had and are the most awarded minority in each and every war this country's ever had. And I'm talking about the American Revolutionary War, where 10,000 unrecognized Latino patriots fought. Cuban women in Virginia sold their jewelry, the hoop earrings and doorknockers, to feed the patriots. And Galvez, General Bernardo Galvez, he was like the George Washington of the South, donated $70,000 worth of weapons to George Washington. And 20,000 of us fought in the Civil War, in the North and the South. You know, we'll go wherever they pay us. You know how we do.
You know what's so interesting is, like, you know, listening to a lot of different interviews that you've done talking about putting the show together is that you had to go out and learn this history. And I mean, look, you've said things I didn't know, and I took history classes in college, and this stuff never was brought up. Was it hard to find concrete research?
The difficulty, which is crazy, that it's all out there because they're facts. The crazy thing is they're not in textbooks, not in my kids, not in my textbooks growing up in America, and not in any kids' textbooks right now. That's what's crazy. The difficulty was in culling the right pieces of information that would pique people's interest, that would make them hungry to research and to read. And that was my struggle. What are the pieces of history that would most light fire under people's butts to make them go out and buy these books?
Do you think that there is a push back against learning other cultures? And, you know, I think about it, and maybe you remember this back, it was in 2010, Arizona banned the teaching of Mexican-American studies.
Yep.
And that, I mean, that's a place where you have 30% Hispanic people living in that community. Do you think there's a pushback against wanting to expand and understand all of the cultures that live in this country?
Well, what's crazy is, why is our culture separate from American culture? We discovered this country, built it. I mean, most of it is named by us: California, Khalid Land, Nevada, Snowy Land, Colorado, Red Land, Florida, Flowery Land, New Mexico, Texas. I mean, they're all named by us. We helped make this country. We grew up and made this country and sacrificed for this country. We are part of the history. It's not another culture. That's what's crazy.
Do you think that if there was more in the history books, that there was more discussion, that people would stop seeing us Latinos as other?
Yes, and that's my push. Because my son would not be bullied if this information was in textbooks. If Americans knew that 500,000 Latin people served in World War II, if they knew how much we've sacrificed to the making of this country, then I think the president would be hard-pressed to have this sort of zero tolerance to our immigrants. And the way he doesn't appoint anyone to his cabinet that's of Latin origins, it wouldn't happen. Americans wouldn't allow it.
You know, I was thinking about, and I mean, you're a little bit older than me, but I think we're both Gen Xers.
Oh,
and,
thanks a lot.
Well, you know,
just outing my age.
Just a little bit. But I was thinking about, like, what did you grow up watching? And I was thinking about what I watched so much television as a kid, cartoons or television shows, sitcoms, et cetera. And I was thinking, well, how many Latinos did I have to look up to? And I was like,
zero.
I was trying to think, well, the only ones I came up with, all right, were
Ricky Ricardo.
Well, there was that. There was also Juan, Juan Epstein from Welcome Back, Kotter, if you want to call it that.
Right, Pont, who wasn't even Latin.
That's right, exactly. Ponch from Chips. The only cartoon I could think
Chico
of was
Chico and the Man.
Chico and the Man.
Yeah, Tony Orlando.
Yeah. But look,
he was Puerto Rican.
We're sitting here trying to figure it out. Like, we're trying to think. Did you have anybody that you can remember that you were looking up to?
Well, obviously, Desi Arnaz. I was reading all about him and how he pioneered sitcoms and created Star Trek and The Untouchables. You know, I used him as a pioneer. And then, you know, I always try to find Latin heroes to build my self-esteem. Cesar Romero, who created the Joker. But they were far and few between, you know.
There are more today, though, aren't there? at least.
Oh, a lot more, a lot more. I mean, we have athletes, we have A-Rod, you have Cespedes, we have tons of Latin athletes.
But you know
we've got actors. You have Benicio del Toro, you have America Ferrera, you have J-Lo, you have Mark Anthony. It's still not enough. We're almost 70 million people in this country, and we have so many people out there doing great things that aren't celebrated.
Do you see this new generation of performers, entertainers, comedians inspired by you, and they're doing stuff that you enjoy, you see, and you like?
Oh yeah, there's lots of great stuff going on there. Christopher Rodriguez, a playwright, comedians. There's lots of great work happening out there, and I think with the onset of the digital age, it's democratized things in a way that we don't have to rely on gatekeepers as much.
That was actor, director, and comedian John Leguizamo. The film Critical Thinking about Miami Jackson Senior High's chess team is available now for download. And you can still watch his Netflix special, Latin History for Morons. We've included links to both on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for this Wednesday, October 7th. And a reminder, this is our fall membership campaign. We need support from listeners like you to continue programs like this one. Here is how you can give.